The last thing that we should be doing is encouraging people. There is still a federal law that we need to abide by.
Trump administration signals it may get tough on states with legal pot. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, February 23rd. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, state officials are working with the White House to fund the individual insurance market in Alaska.
They had obviously done their homework in reviewing it.
That was it. Stories ahead. Stay with us.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer said today that he expects the Department of Justice will step up enforcement of federal marijuana laws, but he didn't elaborate on what that might entail. And there are no details yet about how this will affect states that have set up recreational marijuana industries. If enforcement is increased, it could collide with Alaska's voter-approved legalization and damage Alaska's new marijuana industry. Spicer, at a White House press briefing, said President Trump understands that terminal patients and people in pain can get comfort from marijuana. And he pointed out that Congress had already restricted federal policing of medical marijuana.
There's a big difference between that and recreational marijuana. And I think that when you see something like the opioid addiction crisis blossoming in so many states around this country, the last thing that we should be doing is encouraging people. There is still a federal law that we need to abide by.
Spicer told reporters they'd need to inquire at the Justice Department for more details, but he said people can expect greater enforcement against non-medicinal marijuana. The opioid crisis is invoked by both sides of the marijuana debate. Advocates of legal cannabis say it can help treat addiction to drugs like heroin. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, at a Senate hearing last year, argued against lax cannabis rules.
Marijuana is not the kind of thing that ought to be legalized. It ought not to be minimized, that it's in fact a very real danger.
Alaska Congressman Don Young, in conjunction with three other House members who make up the newly formed Cannabis Caucus, issued a statement today saying they hope Spicer's comments don't reflect the president's views. The congressmen say they're ready to educate the Trump administration on the need for more sensible marijuana policies. States like Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and Colorado that have voted to legalize adult marijuana use have been looking to an Obama administration policy, the 2013 Cole Memo, for legal guidance on cannabis. The memo says enforcing federal rules on the drug will not be a priority for the Justice Department in states that have set up their own strict laws regulating legal marijuana. The Walker administration is asking the federal government to take on much of the cost of supporting the individual insurance market. And early interest in the program from the Trump administration is raising its hopes. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchman reports.
Last month, the state launched the Alaska Reinsurance Program to offset the cost of the most expensive treatments covered in the individual insurance market. State Insurance Division head Lori Wing Heyer has asked the new presidential administration for a waiver to pay more than 80% of the cost starting next year.
They were very favorable comments on the waiver, and they had obviously done their homework in reviewing it.
Primera had planned to raise individual insurance premiums 42% this year before the legislature decided to spend $55 million to launch the new program. Those increases were lowered to 7% for Primera customers, but they were higher for Moda customers who had to switch to Primera after their insurer decided to leave Alaska's individual market. That may have driven some Moda customers out of the market. The number of Alaskans who chose individual plans on the federal marketplace fell from 21,000 in the 2016 enrollment period to 17,000 this year. Policy consultant DJ Wilson hosts the State of Reform Healthcare Conferences in Anchorage. He says the reinsurance program has proven its value.
So I don't think there's any question that the underlying program is important. The question is who's going to foot the bill.
Wilson says Alaska has positioned itself well in working with the Trump administration compared with other states.
There are a number of states that are doing absolutely nothing right now, and Alaska is actually in many ways at the forefront of at least trying to wade through or at least not trying to wait for the federal government to come to some decision before they try to act on their own.
The waiver application comes at a time of change in Washington. The Obama administration deemed the application complete 3 days before Donald Trump became president. Trump and the Republican Congress are committed to repealing the Affordable Care Act, but they're also looking for state approaches that will lower costs. That led members of Trump's team to contact Wing Heyer before the inauguration. She says a full repeal may not occur.
I think you're going to see a tweak of the Affordable Care Act. It was a new act. There were some things that probably needed to be amended regardless of who the new president was.
In the Senate Finance Committee Thursday, senators noted the high cost of the program in the future, whether for the state or for the federal government. Wasilla Republican Mike Dunleavy questioned the individual market's future.
It would appear that this may not be sustainable over the long run. And I know we're not the only ones dealing with this, but I'm just wondering at what point will we, the collective we, states, congressional delegation, you name it, get together before we continue to exhaust resources to try and figure this issue out.
If the reinsurance program continues next year, consulting firm Oliver Wyman projects the individual premiums in Alaska could decline by 4%. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
In a letter to the new EPA administrator, Scott Pruitt, the chairman of the House Science Committee, Lamar Smith, asked the agency to rescind its veto of the Pebble Mine. EPA proposed the preemptive Clean Water Act restrictions based on findings from its Bristol Bay watershed assessment. But supporters of the project say they are likely to find a receptive audience with the new administration. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
Texas Republican Lamar Smith has made the EPA's work in Bristol Bay a top priority of the oversight committee he chairs. Over the past several years, House Science has held a number of hearings, deposed witnesses, and reviewed hundreds of pages of documents and emails, leaving Smith of the firm opinion that the agency acted improperly. He voiced that in comments last April.
In the course of the committee's investigation, we discovered that EPA employees colluded with third-party Pebble Mine opponents. They sought to deliberately establish a record that pointed to one outcome. The Pebble Mine will be excluded from the regular permitting process and should be stopped.
In his letter to Administrator Pruitt, Smith called EPA's 2014 preemptive veto unprecedented, biased, and based on questionable science. He wrote that allowing it to stand will create a, quote, dangerous precedent of expansive federal agency powers. Smith called on Pruitt to rescind the restrictions, which have not yet been finalized. A federal judge put a hold on the agency's work surrounding the Bristol Bay watershed assessment while one of Pebble's several lawsuits against EPA is litigated. Scott Pruitt is the former Attorney General of Oklahoma and made a name for himself as a fierce critic of EPA. Pebble CEO Tom Collier says he doesn't know Pruitt well, but he's pleased with these statements.
I read those things with a happy heart, and I think that they bode well for a decision that will reverse what the existing EPA has done and allow us to go into permitting. Some people think that this dispute we've been having with EPA is over whether or not we can build the project. And I can't emphasize enough that it is simply over whether we can file a permit application.
During the last administration, top EPA officials held more than 24 public hearings and took in a mountain of public comments surrounding the Bristol Bay watershed assessment. Most of the public testimony heard and the written comments received were supportive of the agency's work. Kim Williams, the director of NUNAMTA Ilukasdai, says Pebble's opposition will make sure the new administration hears the same message Obama did.
We'll continue to speak out to President Trump and the administrator to reaffirm that this project will need a permit and this region is opposed to any kind of dredge and fill material entering our salmon streams.
Pruitt's EPA has not yet responded to the House Science recommendation. It tossed the agency's watershed assessment and proposed preemptive Pebble veto. The agency has also not yet named a Region 10 administrator to replace Dennis McLaren, who guided the EPA's unique but perhaps fragile work in Bristol Bay. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Aces fold. Alaska's biggest professional sports franchise will close up after this season.
We believe it's all kind of based on the Alaska economy.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Anchorage and Fairbanks to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. Deadline is March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Throughout his presidential campaign, Donald Trump pledged to increase the nation's infrastructure spending. After Trump was elected, Alaska Governor Bill Walker sent the new president an infrastructure wish list from the state. And at the top of that list is the state-led $45 billion gas line project. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, Rasha McChesney has more.
After the November election, Governor Bill Walker sent a letter congratulating Donald Trump for his win and reminding the president-elect about his campaign promise to increase infrastructure spending. Walker sent a similar letter to Trump's Interior Secretary pick, Ryan Zinke, and another to the National Governors Association after it asked for a list of shovel-ready projects to hand over to the president's transition team. Walker says it just makes good economic sense to get the project in front of the new administration.
What's the largest one? And so we started with, he's looking, if the president's looking for large projects to sort of jumpstart the economy and those kinds of things, we start with the largest one. And so the one that helps the U.S. on the balance of payments, you know, creates the most jobs.
But even with presidential support, the project faces significant hurdles, not the least of which is the legislature, which holds the state's purse strings. They've been tightening them each year. Anchorage Senator Kathy Geisel read Walker's letters in her office on the fourth floor of the Capitol. Is that what you would have asked for?
Well, probably not. I'm kind of big on roads myself, and there's several that would allow us to access mineral resources as well. Of course, we know that he believes that the LNG project will cover the shortfall in our budget and provide a huge amount of revenue for the state going forward. I think that's kind of an overstatement.
Geisel's a Republican who chairs the Senate Resources Committee. She acts as a de facto liaison between the body and the state's Gasline Development Corporation, attending all of its board meetings and bringing its representatives before lawmakers. And she was one of two legislators who launched an audit of the corporation, calling for an investigation of what it's done with the $600 million given to it by the state over the last several years. Despite questions she has about the state's ability to lead the massive project, Geisel says she understands why Walker would choose to bring the gas line to the president's attention.
You know, the federal government has been very supportive of our gas line project all along. FERC has been very interested in it, and even President Obama has been very supportive. I'm not sure what else a president could do. They can't really override these regulatory processes.
Walker agrees. He says he's not really asking the administration to do anything specific when it comes to the state's gas line ambitions. He says it's up to the market to decide if the project will go forward. Vivek Chandra, a petroleum economist and founder of Texas LNG, says the market just isn't there for projects as big as Alaska's. Chandra is a geophysicist who worked for ARCO in Alaska in the mid-1990s on an LNG project. Today, his company in Texas is targeting the same markets in Asia that Alaska is going after, though on a much smaller scale.
You know, and the state and everybody else should realize that. In a commodity world, the buyers no longer want to sign very large-scale long-term contracts because they think there's going to be lots of suppliers, and the lowest price wins.
Markets aside, the state has other hurdles to jump over. For one, it hasn't yet taken over the Department of Energy license that would allow it to export natural gas to Asia. Plus, it hasn't gotten control of the land it needs to build the most expensive part of the project, the natural gas liquefaction plant on the Kenai Peninsula. Despite the hurdles, Kenai Peninsula Borough Mayor Mike Navarre says he agrees with Governor Walker that the gas line would be critically important for the state if it were built. Navarre says he still hears from borough residents about the project, but the excitement has faded.
You know, I think the general sense is that people support the project, but recognize that the momentum has slowed considerably.
Still, Navarre says he supports Walker's efforts to bring national attention to the state's dreams of a gas line. He says it would be irresponsible for the governor not to pursue every opportunity out there. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rasha McChesney in Juneau.
Alaska's solar industry lags behind other states. But with prices dropping dramatically around the world, more entrepreneurs are seeing an opportunity. As Rachel Waldholtz of Alaska's Energy Desk reports, one of the challenges they face is convincing people that solar works in Alaska. And in fact, the outlook for the 49th state is sunnier than many might expect.
Anchorage's newest solar array sits on top of a two-story office building downtown. Getting up to see it is a bit of a challenge.
Oh.
Well, here we go.
Climb up a ladder, through a hatch, and onto the roof, and there it is. Stephen Trimble, founder of Arctic Solar Ventures, shows off his company's most recent project.
We're at 888 H Street downtown, overlooking the Park Strip, at an 86 solar panel commercial installation.
86 solar panels sitting in several inches of snow. Over the course of the year, this array will produce almost 15% of the building's total electricity use, which Trimble and VP Chase Christie say is nothing to sneeze at.
This is a 20,000 square foot commercial building.
Built in the 1970s, it has uses a tremendous amount of electricity.
At a cost of about $100,000, the system will pay for itself in about 10 years. Over 30 years, Trimble and Christie estimate it will save the building owner, who in this case is Anchorage Mayor Ethan Berkowitz, some $300,000. Trimble says that's the math that now is making solar pencil out. Alaska doesn't have the generous state or local incentives that have helped the industry thrive elsewhere. But in the last few years, the costs have dropped so quickly that Trimble says those incentives are no longer necessary.
One day I came home and told my wife, who's the third member of Arctic Solar Ventures, and I said, I think I want to start a solar company in Alaska. And she was kind of like, what? That's crazy.
And that reaction, Trimble says that is one of the biggest barriers solar companies face. Education. Educating regulators who often haven't dealt with solar before. Educating a workforce. But above all, educating consumers. Convincing people that solar is an option in Alaska, a place better known for darkness and cold. And that Alaska might even have some advantages. Take this installation. There's snow on the roof, snow on the roads, snow on the Park Strip. And that is actually a plus, says Erin Whitney of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. She says March and April can be particularly good months for solar power in Alaska.
And that's because of the position of the sun as well as the reflection of light from snow surfaces, as well as, I would actually add to that, cold temperatures, which enhance solar photovoltaic production.
Snow and cold. Call it Alaska's secret solar superpower. Boosters like to point out the state's solar potential is comparable to Germany, which is the world leader in solar installations. But Whitney says we aren't exactly on the edge of a solar revolution.
The solar industry is still very nascent.
In a recent report, Alaska ranked 51st out of 50 states. The list also includes Washington, D.C., in solar jobs per capita. The report notes that Alaska's solar jobs actually doubled from 2015 to 2016 to a grand total of 64. For reference, that's less than half the number of jobs in the next lowest performer, Wyoming. For Stephen Trimble, this is a moment of opportunity and risk. His company hasn't turned a profit yet. They're hoping to cross that threshold later this year. The installation downtown is their biggest system to date. Trimble and Christie like to keep an eye on it.
We drive by it a lot, make sure it's doing good. Yep.
Yeah, we like it up here. We hope to see a lot more just like this.
Standing in the sunshine, surrounded by buildings with wide open southern exposure and, as yet, no solar panels, the pair say their goal is to turn this stretch of Anchorage into Solar Row. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Alaska Humanities Forum is seeking leaders representing different interests and roles across Alaska's salmon communities and industries who want to work together, learn from one another, and build strategies for the future of our state. This 18-month commitment includes 4 week-long gatherings, granting individual awards of $10,000, and approving additional funding for projects. Apply by Tuesday, February 28th at akhf.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Humanities Forum.
The state's only professional sports franchise, the Alaska Aces, will fold after this season. The decision was announced this morning, as APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Terry Parks is a managing member of the Aces ownership group. After years of declining revenue, he says the choice to fold was a business decision.
You know, we bought this team out of bankruptcy almost 15 years ago, and turned it around, and now we have to suffer the consequences of closing it down because of lack of attendance to the games, and we believe it's all kind of based on the Alaska economy.
The team's sponsorships are down $600,000, and ticket sales have dropped more than $250,000. The past couple seasons, attendance is down too. About 1,500 fewer people are showing up for any given game, more than a 25% drop over the past 3 seasons. Others expect to take a hit as well. Chris Schutte directs the Office of Economic and Community Development for the Municipality of Anchorage. The city owns the Sullivan Arena, and Schutte says the Aces account for about 60% of the facility's revenue.
In 2016, we did about $1.5 million of revenue from Aces-related activities. And so that's renting the building, box office ticket sales, food and beverage sales, parking, things like that.
Though the departure leaves a huge gap, Schutte says SMG, the company that operates the Sullivan Arena for the Muni, is already working to fill in space left by the Aces.
It's weird. There's a silver lining almost in the loss of the Aces in that the building itself becomes more available. And that gives SMG broader latitude in booking the facility for other types of events, concerts, comedy shows, things like that.
Aside from the drop in revenue, Schutte says the largest losses to Anchorage's hockey community and the generations of kids who have long been inspired by the Aces. That's a sentiment Terry Parks agrees with.
The hockey community certainly is sad to see the Aces go. We're sad to see it go. We've been involved with it for going on 22, 23 years as a sponsor before we purchased it. So, you know, we all have a lot of energy and effort into it, but you can't continue to run a business that's losing significant amount of money.
The team will play out the remainder of the season, with the regular season wrapping up in early April. All of the players will become free agents. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
During last year's Iditarod, an intoxicated snow machiner struck Jeff King and Ali Zirkel's teams on a section of trail heading into Nalato. And the implications of that event are shaping aspects of this year's Iditarod. Speaking with KNOM's Emily Schwing just a few hours after the incident last March, King described what happened.
One of the many snow machines that were on the river struck my team at high speed. Did not hit my sled or me, and I am fine. I was not hurt in any way. But several of my dogs were hit. One was killed, one's leg was broken, appears broken, and one is in serious condition with shock and impact.
The snow machiner, Arnold Demoski, pleaded guilty in a Fairbanks court last December. He was sentenced to 6 months in jail in order to pay almost $37,000 in restitution. In the time that's gone by, King sees the assault as a crucial factor in a change to the Iditarod's rules. Speaking at his Husky Homestead property outside Denali Park recently, King explained the late-night emergency on a remote stretch of trail is a big part of why Iditarod's board voted to allow two-way communication devices on the trail this year.
They're trying something new to deal with a potential scenario with readily available equipment.
The change in regulations fits into Rule 35 governing electronic devices. It says that a musher can carry and use any two-way communication device, including cell phones and satellite phones. But racers don't have to carry them, like some of the other mandatory equipment. And just as King is explaining all of this, he's interrupted by his own two-way communicator.
I will not carry a different device, and it won't change anything for me unless it means I get beat by somebody who's using it
for a competitive advantage, in which case it would change a whole bunch of our...
King ran his first Iditarod in 1981 and has won the race four times. Throughout his career, he's adapted in order to gain an edge. And he sees the two-way communication rule as just another developmental step, not a fundamental change to top-tier dog mushing. That's a view shared by the race's governing body. Aaron Burmeister is a board member and Iditarod veteran and says even though mushers can now call in an emergency from the trail, their race is still over if they accept any outside help.
This is one of those rules that has evolved over time, and I don't think it's going to make a big impact on the race. Your best team is still going to win the Iditarod.
Burmeister agrees that the incident last year heading toward Nolato was a tipping point for many who worry about safety along the trail, especially now that total isolation is an option and no longer a technological fact.
There were several instances, not just Jeff's, but Allie's and another musher as well, that had incidents on that stretch of the trail. And having a two-way communication device that they would have been able to use following their incidents certainly would have, they felt, would have made them more comfortable and not nearly as scared with what took place.
The board debated requiring mushers to carry devices inside a locked or sealed case, but ultimately decided it'd be too cumbersome. Besides, Burmeister says that if the point is safety, then there's no use creating another barrier to acting fast. There are still traces of the snow machine assault at King's Kennel. His three-year-old, Nash, is gone. Another dog who was struck, Crosby, can't compete anymore. King, though, says he feels closure over what happened.
I feel very lucky that I was not seriously hurt or killed and that not more dogs were hurt. And I take some satisfaction in believing that Arnold Demoski has sincere remorse. And sincere remorse is a great step in the right direction.
This year's Iditarod starts March 4th. And if you're hungry for more about mushing, check out the Iditapod, a podcast about the Iditarod from Alaska Public Media and KNOM in Nome. You can find it on our website or subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And that is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media, follow us on Twitter at APRN, and subscribe to the new Iditapod podcast through iTunes. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman and Arasha McChesney in Juneau, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Josh Edge and Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Mr. Eric Bork. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. Lori Townsend is our news director. And I am Zachariah Hughes. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and in the 40 years of Alaska operations.
And by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com. The Bristol Bay Subsistence Regional Advisory Council is meeting in Naknek February 28th and March 1st at Dolly's Hall from 8:30 to 5 to develop proposals to change federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations for the 2018 to 2020 regulatory years and discuss other issues related to subsistence. The public is encouraged to participate either in person or by teleconference. For all the information about the meetings, go online to doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. Contact the Office of Subsistence Management to receive meeting documents or to request special accommodation needs by 7 business days prior to the meeting. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.